From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
An FBI informant joined our group. Now the Bush administration has outlawed fundraising for Irish political prisoners. This is the story of the FBI's use of informants to compromise legal organizations in the United States.
Today we'll look at why the Bush administration has banned Irish groups that are legal in Britain and Ireland and what the FBI has to do with it. Vladimiro Montesinos is captured in Venezuela and sent to Peru. We'll go to Lima to speak with an opposition parliamentarian. And a look at the deadly consequences of smart sanctions. A conversation with the former Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations about Iraq. All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A Peruvian police aircraft believed to be carrying ex-spymaster Vladimiro Montesinos, who was expelled from Venezuela to face corruption and human rights charges at home, landed before dawn today at a military airport in Peru's northern Amazon. This, according to radio reports, we'll be going to that story in just a few minutes. And this news from Madrid protests. Riot police charged thousands of anti-globalization protesters in Barcelona, gathered in a city park on Sunday following a midday march down a main boulevard. At least 32 people were slightly injured and 19 were arrested. Thousands of screaming demonstrators, some with small children, fled in panic as the police pushed into the crowd behind shields, wielding nightsticks and firing blanks. The march was organized to coincide with a World Bank meeting originally scheduled for this week. Officials canceled the meeting last week to avoid protests that have marred similar meetings over the past 2 years. This news from San Diego. 1,000 demonstrators, some dressed as ears of corn or genetically engineered tomatoes, staged a colorful but largely peaceful protest Sunday on the opening day of the largest annual biotechnology conference. Many demonstrators said they're concerned that businesses are introducing genetically modified crops and seeds into the food supply without knowing the long-term consequences. In other biotech news, more than 150 governments gathered in Rome on Friday for what many see as a make-or-break meeting, which will determine whether the genes of the world's major crops remain in the public sector or are allowed to be further patented. The UN's Food and Agricultural Organization, most European Union governments, many G77 developing nations and grassroots non-governmental groups and farmers' networks are concerned about biopiracy, in which commercial companies patent germplasm, the part of the germ cell that contains hereditary material, and privatize gene banks. Shops and a pub were set on fire last night in a second night of racial violence in the northern English town of Burnley. The trouble followed an attack on Saturday by a gang of white men on an Asian taxi driver in the Lancashire mill town, 30 miles from the scenes of racial violence in Oldham earlier this month. Community leaders said police were slow to respond to the incident, which triggered hours of protests on Saturday night. Princeton University professor Richard Falk has been placed under police protection after saying that the Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon is indictable for war crimes. Richard Falk took part in the BBC program Panorama, which caused a storm in Israel last week for publicly accusing Sharon of playing a leading role in the 1982 slaughter of 800 Palestinian refugees at the Sabra and Shatila camps in Lebanon. Since the broadcast, Professor Falk, who is Jewish, has received threatening telephone calls, including a specific physical threat to him and his wife. Human Rights Watch this weekend urged a criminal investigation into Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon in his role in the Sabra and Shatila massacre. The call by Human Rights Watch came as Prime Minister Sharon begins a visit to the United States. The Washington Post reported this weekend that President Bush will face further questions this week about his administration's ties to big business following fresh disclosures about Vice President Dick Cheney's term as chief executive of Halliburton Company, a Texas oil conglomerate whose subsidiaries signed contracts to sell more than $73 million in equipment to Iraq.
When we were children, we thought we would be God's anointed, but the joke is on you and me. 10 years later, we're still searching for the sun. But I want you to know that our day will come. You can break down my door, you can even strip search me. Never come. By politicians' speeches, I want you to know I love you forever. Our dreams will continue in the eyes of our children. You can break down my door, you can even strip search me. Never gonna take away my human dignity. Beat me, shoot me, flame keep on burning. Strip search me, never gonna take away my human dignity. Beat me, shoot me, flame keep on burning. Never gonna put out the fire of freedom. React with silence. One love for you, for me it's another. Things got to change, you're my sisters and brothers. Oh, Rashidaba, oh, are you? Oh, Rashidaba, oh, are you? Oh, Rashidaba, oh, are you? Misha, Chantan, Tara, hey! Don't use the color of my skin as an issue.
politician, your lies are gonna get you. Chickens coming home to roost in the White House. Blood on the streets if you don't shut your big mouth. Later, we're back at the beginning. Sick of waiting round for divine intervention. Take to the streets if you're looking for redemption.
Black 47, Fire of Freedom, here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. A Peruvian police aircraft believed to be carrying ex-spymaster Vladimiro Montesinos, who was expelled from Venezuela to face corruption and human rights charges at home, landed before dawn today at a military airport in Peru's northern Amazon, this according to radio reports. Montesinos was the right-hand man of the disgraced ex-president Alberto Fujimori. He sparked a mammoth corruption scandal last year, arrested in Venezuela Saturday after 8 months on the run and expelled to face trial at home. He faces charges ranging from embezzlement of state funds to illicit arms and drugs deals and running death squads. His capture was announced by the Venezuelan president Hugo Chavez yesterday at an Andean summit and ended this 8-month manhunt. We're joined on the telephone right now in Lima, Peru, by Javier Diaz Canseco, who is a parliamentarian just recently elected. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning. How are you?
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about the reaction in Peru right now about Montesinos, well, allegedly flown back into Peru in the last few hours?
Well, there is great expectation, and there is a great interest in having Montesinos back so that he can stand trial. He has around 9 judicial processes now in the Peruvian legal system, and he is accused of several crimes that would imply a life sentence that go from drug trafficking to process in which he bought arms for the Peruvian army during the conflict with Ecuador, which were absolutely useless from some of the ex-Soviet republics. And he has also several accusations that deal with tremendous violations of human rights, which include the action of paramilitary groups that are responsible of several massive killings in Peru during Fujimori's regime. As it is well known, he was the right hand of Alberto Fujimori, and really he was the strong man of Fujimori's government and has also had central responsibility in an extended mafia corruption system that controlled the Peruvian government in the past 10 years.
Were you yourself a target of Vladimiro Montesinos?
Yes, quite early in Fujimori's government, my house was dynamited by the intelligence paramilitary groups. When I was president of the Senate's investigation commission that dealt with telephone taping, we proved that it existed. We identified the people responsible of doing it. We identified as early as November 1990 that Montesinos was a strong man in the intelligence system, and we identified the responsible man for electronic intelligence, which is now in jail. But Fujimori's coup in 1992 stopped the judicial process and finally guaranteed absolute impunity for Montesinos. In 1997, my car was assaulted. My security personnel was shot in the leg, and the chauffeur, the security man, and a human rights activist were kidnapped, interrogated for around 1 hour, and then they were left near my house, and my car was robbed, and it was finally set on fire 48 hours after that. These are a couple of the incidents, if we could call them so, that I had with Mr. Montesinos' and Fujimori's security and intelligence groups. No?
What do you think will happen right now?
Well, I think that Montesinos will have to be put in a high security jail under civilian control. I think he should be strongly isolated, and that finally the Peruvian government will have to decide, and the judiciary, to set up a special group of judges and public attorneys that will have to lead the process of a similar type of the one Italy had, this Mano Politi operation, that is a clean hands operation, that will have to lead an investigation on corruption on the Peruvian political system, on the and on other areas of economic activity, including drug trafficking, and that he will have to hold a trial, and probably this will help Peruvian justice to identify the whole network that penetrated the armed forces, the police, the judiciary, the public attorney system, the ministers of the country, the privatizations, the buying of public debt papers of the Peruvian government during Fujimori, and several other problems that deal also with drug trafficking and human rights violations, which are the principal accusations that he and those that found part of his extensive network in the state will have to stand trial for.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Javier Diaz-Canseco, parliamentarian in Peru. This on the news.
I want to thank you very much, and I'd also like to say that one thing that is also needed is that Fujimori and Montesinos clear up its relationship with the CIA of the United States, which has had a very strong importance in the last years. Thank you.
In fact, the CIA and the and other intelligence organizations in the United States are well known for their involvement with Vladimiro Montesinos. Isn't that right?
That's it.
Well, thank
you. It's something that we would like to be absolutely cleared up.
Well, thanks again for being
Thank
with you. Us, Javier Diaz-Canseco, and God bless you. I hope that your cold is better. You are listening to Democracy Now! We're going to take a break, and then we'll come back to Democracy Now!, where we're going to take a look at the story of FBI infiltrator, agent, who joined legal groups here in the United States, and why the Bush administration has banned groups in Ireland and Britain that are legal there. Stay with us.
When we were children, we thought we would be God's anointed, but the joke is on you and me. 10 years later, we're still searching for the sun, but I want you to know that our day will come. You can break down my door.
hopes and dreams lying in pieces. All of us betrayed by politicians' speeches. I want you to know I love you forever. Our dreams will continue in the eyes of our children. You can break down my door. You can even strip search me. Never gonna take away my human dignity. Even they shoot me, flame keep on burning. Never gonna put out the fire of freedom. You can break down my door. You can even strip search me. Never gonna take away my human dignity. Beat me, shoot me, flame keep on burning. Never gonna put out the fire of freedom. React with silence. One love for you, for me it's another. Things got to change, you're my sisters and brothers. Oh, Russia, the back of Wallia. Oh, Russia, the back of Wallia. Oh, Russia, the back of Wallia. Mission shot down, tower up. Don't use the color of my skin as an issue. Politician, your lies are gonna get you. Chickens coming home to roost in the White House. Flood down the streets if you don't shut your big mouth. Oh, Russia, the back of Wallia. Oh, Russia, the back of Wallia. Oh, Russia, the back of Wallia. Mission shot down, tower.
You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. The leader of Northern Ireland's power-sharing government, David Trimble, was re-elected as chief of his divided Ulster Unionist Party on Saturday on the strength of his demand for immediate Irish Republican Army disarmament. Trimble has threatened to resign as First Minister July 1st and to bring the Protestant Roman Catholic government to a standstill unless the IRA begins to give up its stockpiled weapons under the 1998 Good Friday peace agreement, an ultimatum the IRA's political allies in the Sinn Féin party have rejected. Trimble's anti-agreement opponents within the Ulster Unionists decided not to challenge his leadership of the party before the July 1st deadline, and so he ran unchallenged despite the important losses the party suffered in this month's parliamentary and local elections to a hardline Protestant party in Sinn Féin. Sinn Féin's Martin McGuinness, who serves as education minister in the provincial government, said it's a bit rich for people to be focusing on guns that have been silent for the last 7 years when we're witnessing attacks by people who are heart set on destroying the Good Friday Agreement. The political crisis follows several days of sectarian street violence in the north of the capital, Belfast, in which Catholic children had to be escorted to school through a Protestant area and pipe bombs and gunshots were traded. The British government announced Friday that it plans to send an additional 1,600 troops to Northern Ireland in anticipation of the annual marching season, when parades by Protestants commemorating centuries-old battlefield victories over Catholics heighten tensions and often lead to clashes. The government said it also has borrowed 2 water cannons from Belgium. Meanwhile, activists in the United States are fighting the Bush administration's decision to outlaw any support in the U.S. for the families of Irish political prisoners. Last month, the U.S. State Department barred fundraising for the Irish Republican Prisoners Welfare Association and the 32-County Sovereignty Committee, both of which are legal in Britain. We're joined right now by John McDonough with the Irish Freedom Committee. He's also a producer at Pacifica Station WBAI here in New York, the radio program Radio Free Erin, which airs on Saturday afternoons. We're also joined on the telephone by Rory Duggan, who is treasurer of the Irish Republican Prisoners Welfare Association. And we're joined by Lynn Burnaby, who is an attorney with Burnaby and Katz in Washington, dealing with the banning of these groups. John McDonough, let's start off with you. This whole issue of the banning of the parties that goes together with an FBI informant that joined your group as well as others.
Well, the evidence that we're now finding out, David Rupert, who joined the Irish Freedom Committee, which is a legal organization in this country, we're now finding out has been on the payroll of the FBI since the mid-90s and also on the payroll of British intelligence. Now, the American government has always stated that Irish Americans were raising money and funding, quote-unquote, terrorist organizations. In the 80s and the 90s, they used to say Irish Northern Aid sent money to the provisional IRA, which was totally false, and they were sending it to the families of political prisoners. They've been stating now that the Irish Freedom Committee is funding terrorist organizations in Ireland, and we've always stated, and we state that any money that we send over to Ireland, we receive receipts that it goes into legal bank accounts in Ireland. So the government then sends in an FBI informant to join the Irish Freedom Committee. While in the Irish Freedom Committee here in New York, we had problems with David Rupert, who happens to be 6'7" and 300 pounds. He would fly in from Chicago and attend meetings and bring up disruptive things at meetings in order to divide.
Now, explain again who he is.
He's just like the Irish Freedom Committee is a totally legal organization. If you listen to BAI on Saturday, we give out where there's meetings for the group. Anyone can come down. You join the group and the organization for political reasons, not ethnic reasons. We have Italians that are involved. We have Puerto Ricans that are involved. It would be just like joining, stopping the bombing of Vieques. It is a political organization, and the money raised goes specifically to the families of political prisoners.
And David Rupert is?
He's an FBI informant who's been on the payroll of the FBI and a classic agent provocateur. At the time, we didn't know that. We just thought he was causing trouble at the meetings. Eventually, the people in New York threw him out with all the other people in Chicago.
On what grounds? What was he actually saying?
He was trying to divert the money to other organizations. And we said, we'll set up an organization to fund those groups if you want, but you cannot use the Irish Freedom Committee to fund other groups in Ireland. And he basically told us he will do whatever he wants with the money that he raises in Chicago. And we said, that's not good enough. We're putting you out of the organization. So goes back to Chicago with his group. They're fundraising there. Allegedly, he was given money to bring over to Ireland. And now I believe the government will probably allege that he gave it to illegal organizations in Ireland and not to the groups that they were supposed to go to. And I just wanted to read quickly from an email, because emails can be very dangerous. The FBI not only tracing or tapping computers and giving the email off. In this instance, Dave Rupert, who was sending emails, was an FBI informant, so we didn't have to worry about the FBI intercepting the emails. They were getting them directly, and I hope people out there realize with what's going on with Pacifica that your email will be forwarded to the FBI and be very careful of what is sent to people on the board of Pacifica. But here's this is an FBI agent writing to a member in the Irish Freedom Committee about what he wants to do with the Irish Freedom Committee. In any case, at this time, we could do one of three things. We can hold meetings of the board of directors. We can reroute the focus of the organization to what it was intended to be, a loosely knit group of independent units with small national footprint. We can split with McDonough-oriented New York units and go ahead and establish this ourselves, or we can simply take over. We lose McDonough and a few fellows in New York City, but we gain a good number in the city. McDonough's problem is he does not want to give up the name, nor do we. If he would talk to me, I would suggest him to keep the Comanisciotia name, and we would take the Irish Freedom Committee name. But he won't answer my phone calls or respond to my emails, thank God. But this is him plotting already.
He was trying to divide Chicago from New York.
Right, or take it over completely on behalf of the FBI. So his intentions all along was to cause a division within the Irish Freedom Committee, which he did. And then we believe he compromised a lot of people in Chicago, which now the Bush administration, you'll be speaking to the lawyer that's bringing the case, could be using David Rupert, an FBI informant, to justify the banning of legal organizations in Ireland. And it has to be remembered, Irish Americans have a proud tradition in this country of raising funds for Irish political prisoners going back 150 years, and now they're trying to stop that.
Let's go to Lynn Burnaby in Washington, an attorney with Burnaby and Katz. Can you explain what happened with the Bush administration last month and why they put more organizations on the so-called terrorist list?
Yes. Good morning. They designated the real IRA as a terrorist organization, and then they designated two groups as aliases of the real IRA. Those were the 32 County Sovereignty Committee and the Irish Republican Prisoners Welfare Association that we just heard about. And, you know, basically these are not the real IRA. They are they conduct political activities. They have they participate in demonstrations. The 32 County Sovereignty Committee puts out a newspaper out of New York, but they are groups that, and the Republican welfare, the Republican Prisoners Welfare Association puts out provides support to the families of political prisoners, but they are not groups that are involved in any way in violent activities. And as Mr. McDonough said, they are totally legal in Ireland, and in fact, they are. There's even elected officials that participate or lead these organizations in Ireland. So there is no. This is the first time the State Department has designated groups that are do not have a wing or a part that carries out violent activities. These are purely political groups that are opposed to the peace process. And so this was sort of an extraordinary expansion of the use of the Terrorist Act to designate them as terrorists.
And you had to get a special dispensation even to get involved with this case?
That's right. Any lawyer that represents a group that's designated as a terrorist group must get a license from the Department of Treasury simply in order to represent groups, because the way the law is written, even providing pro bono legal services could be considered support that would be illegal under the Act. So it's very, very broad-reaching. It does not include just fundraising for the groups. For instance, Martin Galvin, who puts out the newspaper for the 32 County Sovereignty Committee in New York, you know, he has subscribers. There's people that contribute to the newspaper. And even those persons could be seen as contributing to a terrorist organization under the current designation. The other thing, and this sort of goes into what we were just speaking about, is that the reason it's so dangerous is sort of the manner in which the State Department goes about doing this. And what they largely have done up to the current time is they have designated groups as terrorist organizations based on secret evidence. And the D.C. Circuit, which hears these challenges to designations, at the beginning of June came out with a case in which they said that groups designated as terrorists have the right to challenge that designation before the Department of State. And we've, in this case, have asked for that as well as challenge the designation in court. We've asked for a due process hearing and to hear what kind of evidence the State Department has to designate these groups as terrorist organizations. We haven't heard a response to that request, but it seems to me that, you know, if this decision stands from the D.C. Circuit, and I might say it was a very conservative panel, two out of the three judges are very conservative, that heard this, that we would expect that we would get a hearing and supposedly see all of the evidence, including the secret evidence that the State Department supposedly has to designate these groups as terrorists. The real danger in this whole area up to this point has been is that the State Department can really operate totally in the dark and just designate groups as terrorist organizations without producing any public evidence of the basis on which they've done so.
Well, let's go to Rory Duggan in Dundalk, Ireland, treasurer of the Irish Republican Prisoners Welfare Association. What is this terrorist designation meant for your group?
Well, first of all, hello, and I want to thank you for giving us the opportunity to speak to such a wide audience in the United States, and also I'd like to say hello to the two guests on the program. What it has meant to us is basically that the small amount of funding that was coming in forms of donations from the United States has now stopped. The direct result of that there is that prisoners' families and their children and their dependents, etc., are suffering as a result. I'd just like to put it on the record very clearly that that our organisation is not a terrorist organisation. We are not engaged in violent activity. I myself was a member of Sinn Féin for approximately 22, 23 years. I resigned from Sinn Féin because of the direction that the leadership were going in relation to the settlement in the six counties. In the 4 years or 5 years that I have left Sinn Féin, my home has never been raided. I have not been arrested. I go about my lawful business. I run a business here in Ireland. We have an open bank account in Dundalk and in Derry City. The bank account is monitored, I'm quite sure, by the intelligence services. We have an annual general meeting in which our national executive is elected, where full committee reports, etc., and financial undertakings are given on what money came in and what money goes out is accounted for. And quite frankly, to class the Republic of Prisoners Welfare Association and also the 32 County Sovereign Movement as aliases for the real IRA is just basically a smokescreen by the Bush administration to stem the tide, the growing tide of Republican discontent and disenchantment with the Adams leadership.
Does the banning of the Irish Republican Prisoners Welfare Association also mean you can't come into the United States?
Well, I was banned from the United States well prior to this. Approximately 2 years ago, John would give you the exact date there. Myself and Bernadette McKevitt were in the United States for the 32 County Sovereignty Movement. We lodged a document in the United Nations, a submission with the United Nations, challenging the legality of Britain's rights to sovereignty over the six counties. We've been actively pursuing that document. On our arrival home, about 4 to 6 weeks later, I received a letter from the American Embassy in Dublin stating that my visa had been revoked. I had been in and out of the United States of America approximately 10 times, albeit on holidays, etc. I had an indefinite visa. I have no convictions. I run a business. Recently, I've acquired a publican's license, which means that you go before a local judge and the local police, etc., testify to your character. My taxes is up to date, etc., etc.
Rory Duggan, you're the treasurer of the Irish Republican Prisoners Welfare Association, so presumably you know where the money goes. Where does it go?
It goes directly to the families of the prisoners and their dependents, and also money is sent directly periodically to the prisoners' account in the jail, for so that they can purchase materials for crafts, etc., and in tuck shop stuff like that. There, you know. But to say that we diverted funds to the real IRA. It's just a complete nonsense. Our bank account is opened. It's an open and honest bank account.
And explain what is meant by the real IRA.
I don't really understand your question. You want me to explain the real IRA?
Yeah, or let me ask John McDonough here in the studio. John, for listeners who aren't up on Irish politics.
Well, it would take quite a while, but essentially there's always been armed resistance to the British presence in Ireland, and it's went under many names, whether it was the Irish Republican Army, the Provisional IRA, the Irish National Liberation Army. There's groups now called the Continuity Irish Republican Army, and what the media are terming the real IRA or the real Irish Republican Army, but what they would term themselves at their direct descendants of 1916 uprising in Dublin, and they're doing nothing different than what has been going on for Ireland for hundreds of years.
But this is a group that has splintered from the IRA.
Oh, from the Provisional IRA, yes.
And now is the head of the real IRA on trial?
Allegedly the head. He is Michael McKevitt. He's the husband of Bernadette Sands McKevitt, and Bernadette Sands is the sister of Bobby Sands, who died on hunger strike in 1981. He's currently being held in Portlaoise Prison under the charges of directing terrorism, the first time this law has been used, and it carries a life sentence. And guess who the sole witness is? An American citizen called David Rupert. David Rupert, who is now in the protective custody here in the United States. At taxpayers' dollars, he's being housed somewhere, given another identity, and he's testifying in a foreign jurisdiction. There's no charges pending against anyone in this country that he has to be in protective custody, and he'll be testifying in a Dublin court that has no jury and just three judges. And Rory, maybe you could tell, what type of court will David Rupert be going to?
Oh, he'll be going to a non-jury court. It's quite notorious in Irish history. It was originally set up as a death court in that it was chaired by three military officers. This was later refined by the 26 county government to give it a veer of respectability, and they introduced the judiciary to it. When it came into being initially, it could only pass two sentences, either not guilty or death. That has been refined over the years, and certainly over the last 30 years, it was the model on which the British introduced the Diplock court system in the six counties. And it is notorious for handing down harsh sentences. And the main principle of the Special Criminal Court is that you're guilty. You are guilty, and that you must prove to the court your innocence.
They had a case there with a member of a Republican group who was found guilty for not giving evidence. If you remain silent, that will be taken inference of your guilt.
That's right. They introduced laws here recently where they have basically, if you exercise your constitutional right to silence, that the court can draw an inference from your silence as some sort of implying your guilt, and that the judges can use this as their basis for convicting you on, say, being a member of an illegal organization.
As we wrap up, though, David Rupert, you don't know where he is right now, and you threw him out of your group.
Right.
What
effect
does that have on your group in the
United
States?
Well, it sets you back organizing, because you're constantly bickering with other cities, whether it's Boston or Chicago. But if people want to get up to date on what's going on with David Rupert, you can go to irishfreedom.net. We have a biography of him, a picture of him, and also a lot of the email that he sent around to members. And you can really build up a profile of an FBI informant if you look at that. It's irishfreedom.net. And Rory, how can people help out with the families of Irish political prisoners?
Well, what they can do is, and I would be very grateful if they would like to send a gift directly to myself or to our bank account in Ireland. The account number is 5813-0183, and that is AIB Bank, Dundalk, County Louth, Republic of Ireland. Our sort code is 932450, and or they can send their gifts directly to me at 1 Mary's Court, Mary Street North, Dundalk, County Louth, Republic of Ireland.
Now, at this point, would this be considered illegal in the United States, Rory Duggan?
Well, ask Lynn.
Or Lynn Burnaby.
It may be. I mean, what's sort of going on now, I mean, just in terms of, you know, your show, which is, you know, one of the few shows that will present information like this, is it shows that if the government is successful in designating these groups as terrorist groups, it will stop a lot of their informing of the American public about these issues, because you're not going to read this in the New York Times or the Washington Post. And so if the government is successful in suppressing these groups by designating them terrorist groups, this is a lot of information the American public isn't going to get to know and isn't going to be able to act upon, which is, you know, my sense is this is exactly what the State Department wants. They don't want this kind of information about what's really going on in Ireland, about the kangaroo judicial system, about the, the political differences in Ireland over the peace process. They don't want that kind of information to reach the American public, because people might have second thoughts about the peace process as it's currently been set up.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you all very much for being with us. Rory Duggan joining us from Dundalk, Ireland, treasurer of the Irish Republican Prisoners Welfare Association. Lynn Burnaby of Burnaby and Katz in Washington, D.C., and John McDonough, who is with the Irish Freedom Committee, producer of Radio Free Erin on Saturdays that airs on Pacifica Station WBAI here in New York. When we come back, we're going to look at so-called smart sanctions in Iraq. We'll be joined by the former Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Last week, Iraqi news reported 23 people were killed, 11 wounded, when British and American aircraft bombed a soccer field near the northern city of Mosul. U.S. and British officials deny the raid took place. U.S.-British planes patrolling a no-fly zone they unilaterally established in northern and southern Iraq at the end of the Gulf War have killed more than 300 people and injured more than 1,000. A delegation from the Chicago-based group Voices in the Wilderness, the campaign to end sanctions against the people of Iraq, traveled this weekend to Mosul to visit the scene of the bombing and talk to survivors. We will hopefully reach them tomorrow, just returning from Iraq. But right now, Kathy Kelly is on the line with us of Voices in the Wilderness, nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize for the last 2 years for her work to end sanctions against the people of Iraq. What's the latest you heard from the group about whether what killed these 23 people and wounded 11 was bombs from British or American planes, or, as the British and U.S. militaries are suggesting, backfiring of anti-aircraft weaponry?
Well, Amy, the grim details are that they were able to visit the site for about 2 hours, and it was strewn with large pieces of bomb debris, two of which bore English writing with serial numbers and dates, and we've been checking with websites here to try to better understand where that debris might have come from. That's really the best we could say now.
What exactly was the identifiers that they could see?
Well, there's an identification of an MK-82 plane having possibly been the source of one of the pieces of debris, and that's the kind of plane that had been used in the NATO bombing of Kosovo. It takes a while to check these things out, though.
Well, we're going to bring our listeners more on this tomorrow, but we just wanted to get that bit of news out today and then go into another issue, which is deeply affected the people of Iraq. Next month, the UN Security Council will meet to discuss a proposed revision of the U.S.-led sanctions against Iraq more than 10 years after the end of the Gulf War. International support for the sanctions has crumbled in the last year, in part because of the widespread revulsion at the impact of sanctions, which, according to the UN, have killed more than a million civilians. U.S. officials have dubbed their proposal smart sanctions, arguing that the new plan would reduce civilian suffering in Iraq and increase government revenue while preventing Iraq from importing weapons. We're joined now in the studio by Dennis Halliday, who is the former head of the United Nations Oil for Food Program in Iraq, recently returned from a 10-day trip to the Middle East, where he met with Kurdish leaders and Iraqi officials. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Morning, Amy. Good to be here.
It's good to have you. Can you explain first what these smart sanctions proposals are?
Well, it's an attempt by the Bush and Blair governments to further strangle the economy of Iraq by cutting off the revenues that are now coming into the country outside the Oil for Food program, revenues that are being used by the Iraqi government and the Kurdish parties up in the north to invest in consumer industries and infrastructure, which are absolutely necessary if this country is ever to get off the ground.
What did you find out when you went to Iraq?
Well, we find that both of us, as Yvonne Sponik and I, that we spoke in Jordan first, and of course Jordan is extremely concerned about the dangers of the smart sanctions to their economy. Would boost their unemployment rates to a level which would perhaps threaten the stability of the government.
Why?
Because they already have large unemployment, and by closing down the border with Iraq, they would find half a million, maybe a million Jordanians further damaged in terms of their economic well-being. And this would mean that they would not, the economy of Jordan would probably collapse if this border is closed by U.S.-UK pressure.
Hmm. So you went to Jordan. You also...
We then went on to Baghdad, where we discussed with members of the government, the cabinet, and, of course, Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz, the impact of smart sanctions on the economy, well-being of the Iraqi people. Again, they are outraged that the UN would even consider such a device after 11 long years of this economic sanctions regime, and to further try to undermine this economy. Now, those of us who, I think, are close to Iraq understand that, of course, food, healthcare is terribly important, but the real need of the Iraqi people is to rebuild the infrastructure, to bring in the electric power, rebuild education, health care, to get electric power back into water systems, water treatment. Without that, we can never get these this economy off the ground. We'll never actually deal with the health crisis in Iraq. Young children today are dying not for lack of food, in as much they're dying from bad water supplies. And that has got to be dealt with. And only massive investment can do that. And the British and the Americans and the Security Council together are determined to stop that sort of investment. And that is perhaps the source of the crisis right now. The French, however, are slowly turning that around and beginning to talk about foreign investment. That would make a huge difference.
Under the proposal, the U.S. is drawing up a list of items it wants to prevent Iraq from importing. What's on the list?
Well, this is a list of so-called dual-purpose items, which are those which have potential for military or military weapons development usage. It's a totally unrealistic list, and this is really a nonsense, given the fact that you've had 10 years of sanctions. It's time now to deal with the real issues of Iraq and to stop the dying of children and adults, and also to respect the sovereignty of Iraq and its neighbors, both Turkey, Syria, and, of course, Jordan, and get this country back on its feet and bring it back into the international community. This is a totally unacceptable behavioral pattern of the Security Council. We're punishing the people of Iraq, the innocent people of Iraq, because we don't like, or can't get on with, whatever the word is, the government of Baghdad.
I got a chance to interview President Clinton on Election Day, and I think we played for you what he had to say when asking him his response to your and Hans von Sponeck, who followed you as head of the UN All for Food program in Iraq. Both of you quit, saying that the program was genocidal, and he said, "You're just wrong." And he, again, blamed Saddam Hussein and said that he's diverting everything.
Well, you know, as I said, I think President Clinton has been very badly advised. He's still talking about revenue of $40 billion in the last 4 years. This is nonsense. In fact, the real net income for Iraq and expenditures on supplies for Iraq is less than $10 billion. The rest is either on hold in accounts or in the hands of the United Nations or being paid out in breach of international law as compensation in a system operated out of Geneva where the Iraqi government is not properly represented. So President Clinton is just consistently wrong, misinformed, and I'm afraid the Bush regime is following the same trend of misinformation, which again continues to hurt the people of Iraq, not the government in Baghdad. And it also hurts, and I should emphasize, the Kurdish Iraqis of the north, those that I understand Britain and NATO members like Turkey and others want to protect, but in fact they are suffering greatly under sanctions. Their children are also dying from malnutrition and lack of adequate water supplies and health care. The Kurds are also suffering, the Kurdish Iraqis are suffering just as much as those in the south and center of the country.
We're talking to Dennis Halliday, former head of the United Nations Oil for Food program, recently came back from Iraq where he met with Kurdish leaders as well as Iraqi leaders in Baghdad. Who is the engine driving smart sanctions?
It seems to be the United Kingdom as a proxy, I think, for the United States. This seems to be some enlightened, quote-unquote, policy of Mr. Colin Powell to move this thing forward, given the failures of the last few years. It's a complete misnomer. It, I think, is a dishonest program. It's a provocation to Iraq and to its neighbors and to the whole Arab world. The Arab street, I think, is up in arms about what's continuing to be a program of killing innocents in Iraq, and gives the impression that civilian goods will pour into the country. Well, that may well be the case, but if you have an economy where there's massive unemployment and no income, who's going to buy? Who can buy these civilian goods? This is nonsense. You've got to rebuild the economy first and then open the door, not just to civilian goods, but all goods, clearly. And if we're anxious about arms, and we should be anxious about arms supplies in the Middle East and elsewhere in the world, why don't we start looking at the suppliers? We are the suppliers. We, in North America, in Europe, in my own country, Ireland, we are now making billions, if not millions or billions of dollars on the arms trade. This we have got to stop, together working with Iraq, of course, and the neighborhood, which is also heavily armed, and apply some of the provisions which are contained in resolutions of the UN to downgrade weapons of mass destruction in the entire Middle East.
You are very unusual, almost alone at the United Nations in what you have done. I mean, you were the Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations. You then went to Iraq to oversee the program that the United Nations, pushed by U.S. and Britain, has imposed on Iraq. And then you quit. And how long ago did you quit?
Well, it's way back now. It's, in fact, October of 1998.
So it's been 3 years, and then Hans von Sponeck followed. He also quit, and the two of you have been dedicating your lives now to fighting the sanctions regime.
Well, you know, it's not really a choice. It's an obligation. I think both of us have seen up close exactly what happens on the ground when the United Nations Security Council has been corrupted by the United States, assisted by Britain and some other member states. This is a dreadful thing to witness for those of us who've spent together 66 years in the United Nations as a pair, so to speak. And this horrifies us. And we have a sense of obligation that we will stick with this issue and we'll do our best on behalf of the people of Iraq for as long as we can and until this is resolved. And it will be resolved. I mean, the Iraqi government, the Kurds of the North, will win this situation. The history books, I believe, will write this up as genocide and a crime against humanity being committed by the West, led particularly by Washington. It's a matter of time, and I think the Iraqis are dedicated to dignity and honor and pride, and they're not going to give in. They're going to use the only weapon they have at their disposal, which is oil, and they're going to force the West to back down and respect the needs of their people and their innocent populace who are suffering today.
When you say the Iraqis, where do the Iraqi populations stand in relation to Saddam Hussein?
Well, like many other regimes who are pressed by sanctions, I believe the majority of Iraqis support their government in Baghdad. Those Kurds and Kurdish leaders we met in the north say they are proud to be Iraqis. They hold Iraqi passports. They are Iraqis first and Kurdish second. The people of Iraq are surrounded. They feel surrounded by angry, negative forces. They are isolated from their community and the world. They want this to come to an end. They want to get back. They want to run their own country.
Presumably, since you were the Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations, you still have high-level contacts there. What's their response to you?
Well, I must say, I do have contact with high-level links in the UN and in the diplomatic connections to the UN. I think people respect what I did and what Hans von Sponeck has done. They understand why we did it. It shocked them at the time, but they understand the UN is in great danger. Its credibility has suffered. It is indeed being corrupted. And I think it's a concern of many around the world that the UN has lost its credibility.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us again, Dennis Halliday, former Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations, who presided over the United Nations Oil for Food program in Iraq until he quit and called it genocidal.
There are those that would like to lift the sanctions. I am not among them.
Thank you.
From the CD, End the Sanctions, www.vitw.org. That does it for the program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson. Anthony Salone is our engineer, Errol Maitland, our technical director. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of you, our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!
Graduation present for members and their children or grandchildren. Shy San Francisco teenager Mia Thermopoulos, played by Anne Hathaway, discovers one fine day that she's the heir apparent to the crown of the small European principality of Genovia. Mia must choose to pursue her budding romance with her best friend's brother or follow the advice of her formidable grandmother, Clarisse,